The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is a great one because not only am I with someone who's incredibly accomplished, but I'm with a former classmate of mine, Bree Demma. She's the head sommelier at Fogo Island Inn. Used to be at George and Langdon Hall before that. Advanced sommelier from the Quartermaster Sommelier and has her diploma from WSET. Bree, thanks for doing the pod.
Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Now, there's so many places to start. I think I'm going to start with probably for people, just to give people some background, my highest level of wine knowledge you were there for the entire day. And that was the final day of studying for our diploma for WSET. When you did the same thing I did,
yes.
You just stayed in a, you know, crappy hotel by the airport to get away from it all and study.
One difference, though, you did it for 5 days.
5 days.
I did it out of necessity for beating the traffic in the morning.
Yeah.
But it was nice to see your face there, honestly.
And it was total. It was just a total coincidence.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, from that point on, because we both passed.
Yep.
But from that point on, very different directions for both of us. And first off, just congratulations to you and to all your success, not only passing the Advanced Sommelier, which is incredibly difficult. I mean, that is the elite of the elite. But then Langdon Hall, that's a pretty high-end spa resort.
Right.
George, one of the top restaurants in Toronto. And now you're at one of the most interesting hotel. What would you call Fogo Island
Inn? It's referred to as an inn, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very unique place. We were talking about how it's at the four corners of the universe, or four corners of the world, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like living on Mars out there, honestly. It's really different.
Let's start there. And then we're going to start with the present, then we're going to work our way back.
Sure.
Because I want to talk about your journey. I want to talk about the Advanced Sommelier and just
sure.
what the exam was like and your study and the day of and what you remember.
Because
so many people when I talk to about it, they're like, I don't remember anything. I've blacked out.
You've interviewed two of my good friends that I've been through the process with.
Yes.
I think Emily and Julie.
Yep.
So I'm curious to hear how my stories compare to theirs.
Everyone's stories have been very different.
Yeah.
Everyone's stories have been really, really different.
Yeah.
So explain a little bit Fogo Island Inn.
Yes.
And it's been described as one of those incredibly expensive, but also one of those places that you have to go to at one time in your life.
It's really special. It all came about as a passion project by a woman named Zita Cobb. Now, she was raised on Fogo Island in a community called Joe Bat's Arm,
mm-hmm.
which is where the inn is located now. She left the island, pursued her education, you know, did pretty well financially, and wanted to come back and support her community, which was kind of dying. The fishing industry, the cod moratorium in the 90s, and the fishing industry was kind of just barely sustaining everybody who lived there. Her thought was to create a social enterprise called the Shorefast Enterprise, and through that, build the inn, just to bring attention to the communities there and to bring people to this place where I don't know if you would ever go to if there wasn't.
Well, describe this place because the pictures are incredible. It's an incredibly modern-looking building at the edge of the eastern part of Canada.
Yeah.
It looks like something you see from some sci-fi movie or some sort of dystopian future. It's crazy looking. It's dramatic.
It is. It's strange and familiar is kind of the concept or the way that I like to explain it. It's strange in that it looks like it doesn't belong there, but it kind of does. Parts of the architecture, Todd Saunders was the architect for this project, and parts of the architecture were taken from details from buildings that are there on the island or very traditional for Newfoundland, and then of course with his entirely unfamiliar spin on it.
Yeah.
So it's spectacular. It's like nothing else I've ever seen.
What's the wine program like? You are the head sommelier there?
It's small but growing. So
yep.
They've been open for 6 years now.
Yep.
And they've had wine-minded people working for them, but not necessarily somebody dedicated as a wine director or a sommelier.
Right.
So in that sense, it's really a program in its infancy, and it's so exciting to be able to kind of create something there for the first time.
And what drew you? I mean, beyond, you know, it's just an incredible inn, but I'd love to hear just the genesis of did you reach out? Did they reach out to you?
Yeah. A couple different reasons brought me out there. First and foremost, do you know Jonathan Gushue? Chef Jonathan Gushue?
Yes.
So he's the chef that really brought Langdon Hall to its initial limelight with the top... top 100 restaurants of the world.
Yep.
I forget which year that was, but I think they were in the 70s, placed in the 70s. So he went out to Fogo Island after Langdon and after owning a restaurant in Kitchener, where I'm from, called The Berlin.
Yep.
Actually, my boyfriend, who is a sous chef at Fogo Island, he had followed Jonathan out there earlier last year to kind of work and train under him. And initially thought he was going to be coming back to Ontario, but halfway through the year, he kind of said, hey, you should probably come out here and check us out.
Pack your bags and come out here.
Yeah, maybe a little more gently than that. But yeah, like that was the kind of the thought process. So I went out there in July and we did an event with Canadian winemakers. Do you know Leaning Post?
Yeah.
From Ontario? Yeah.
Yep.
Leaning Post from Ontario, Tantalus from BC, and Benjamin Bridge from Nova Scotia. So we did this little kind of Canadian winemakers weekend, and I fell in love with the place, and it all made sense.
Where do you hope to have it a year from now? Because this is great. You are on the ground floor.
Yeah.
And not that other people didn't do stuff before you, but you have this control, and you can sort of I'll start here. How much control do you have over the list?
Autonomy of the list. I love Zita for her passion and her ideas. So she definitely has some things, some framework, let's say, that I'm going to be working within, and I completely respect that. There's a philosophy of the inn that, for example, they're very no intervention, low intervention. All of our food sources are as local as possible.
Right.
So in that sense, I'm looking for wines that kind of reflect that. But yeah, beyond that, it's autonomy of selection, which is wonderfully exciting, as you can imagine. And
so no, there's no J-Lore or Pothic Red on the list.
There won't be any.
What would you like to see the list be?
You know, it's we've kind of landed on this concept that I'm in love with, because I haven't really worked with building a program that has been within a frame or a box, let's say.
Yeah.
So we're going to focus on Canadian wines, of course, to a point. And then we're focusing on the traditional trading partners of Newfoundland. So the first people that would have come to Newfoundland, Portuguese fishermen, obviously first.
Okay,
Spanish,
so,
French, Italian.
Yeah.
So that concept of, you know, what were the first wines that might have been there?
Feels like you should have some Madeira and port and sherry.
Yes, we will have all those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That feels like that's, I mean, especially if you're going to go by old-timey history, then that's sort of where you start and build it from there.
Yeah. And then, of course, not just, you know, not just traditional wines, but wines that are innovative and exciting from those places. So it's a pretty big playground when you think of it like that.
Well, let's bounce back. I want to talk about, and I want to talk about sort of the compare and contrast between just the wine culture there versus George versus Langdon Hall. And also you will be giving a tasting notes on what we're drinking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I do it every now and then. Yeah. I did it with Emily.
Yep.
I did it with Bruce Wallner. So I'm going to put you through it. We're drinking, some old Riesling. We're at the National Club, recording this, and yeah, they got some crazy old wines here. And
I saw the cellar earlier. Yeah, it's really neat.
The advanced. Take me through it. What was the? Take me to that to where you were the morning of.
Oh boy. Well, I attempted the advanced exam twice. The first time I was unsuccessful with the tasting.
Yeah.
So
let's go to there. Let's start there.
Yeah. Of course.
What do you remember? Because they don't. For people who don't know, they never reveal the wines you try. But
that's right.
You probably have a pretty good idea what happened.
You know what? Actually, I don't remember the wines from the first exam. Probably because it was a slightly traumatizing experience. Maybe not traumatizing, but...
Oh, no, no, no. You know, hold on. You can call it traumatizing.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
How much time and effort and study and blood and sweat did you put in on that?
Yeah.
Which would have been a ton. So, you know, to fail that, yeah, that would stink.
Even more so, I realized the first attempt in my tasting flight how underprepared I was for tasting.
Really?
And I think that was kind of what was most shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it opened my eyes to how much work you really need to put in. In that sense, it was traumatizing.
Now, you might not be able to be specific, but
yeah.
I'm curious. Like, was it just you were nosing one wine and like, I can't figure out what this is. I'm not like...
It was the third white that I took way too much time on. It was neutral.
Yep.
It wasn't speaking to me, I guess. And then by the time I got to my reds, I was like my last red. I was just desperation trying to finish the end of the grid. I think I might have gotten the conclusion, but it was like
your journey there. You might have got the conclusion, but your journey there was flawed.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So they did give me notes, feedback on that, where it was, you know, pretty clear that that was a point of weakness for me, but
yep.
It was constructive feedback. So.
And
obviously,
then,
it worked out. I passed the second time.
So go to the second time, and not just tasting, but also what do you remember from theory?
Theory?
And the reason I'm asking this is people that want to get a little behind the curtain of the sort of questions that are asked or just how intense it actually is. You know, so I always enjoy talking to people that, you know, that have passed at the variety of levels and just what it was like.
I think it's funny because... between the first and second attempt for theory, the theory seemed more difficult on the second attempt, despite my extra year of studying.
Well, because you never know the random questions.
Right?
Yeah.
You think that after the second year, you'd feel twice as confident.
Mm-hmm.
But leaving the exam, I was a little bit more shaken and thinking maybe... I really enjoy theory, so it wasn't the most difficult day to walk out of.
Do you remember any of the questions?
Oh, gosh. You're putting me on the spot here. I'm going to try and remember some for you by the end of this.
And by the way, you can go, no, bugger off. How to remember that. Well, what were your impressions from that day? And if I can get you to hold the mic a little bit closer.
Yeah, of course. Sorry about that.
No. I mean, I'm going to edit this afterwards.
I kind of forgot it was down there.
I know. And I'm going to bump your audio anyway. But
fair enough.
Yeah. So what were your impressions from your successful passing of it?
From the successful time? So I was, you know what? I'd really started to meditate at that point.
Yep.
May I do this?
Of course.
Okay.
And by may I do this, it means pouring a little bit more. What are we drinking, by the way? And I'm going to ask you because you've got better pronunciation than I do.
Okay. Oh, thank you. German is never my strong suit, but it's 2003 vintage of Peaceporter Goldtröpfchen, mm-hmm. St. Urban's Hof.
And when you say that name to people who don't know, what information does that label tell you?
So Goldtröpfchen is a vineyard... designation. Peace Border is the greater region that surrounds the Goldtröpfchen.
Yep.
Area.
And it's how is it, by the way? Well,
you know.
Rather, cheers.
Cheers.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's still really alive.
It's still really alive. Do you want that tasting note now?
No. We'll do it after. We'll do it. Right. I first want your final impressions from the advanced psalm.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was considerably calmer the second time around because I did start meditating pretty heavily before, about 6 months or a year to the lead up,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think maintaining your nerves is a really big part of your success at that exam, especially in the service when it can seem like chaotic and...
They're being mean to you.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have that experience of thinking they're being mean, but they're certainly trying to test you. So that was helpful. Having a more calm state of mind. Having been through it once before, you get the experience of knowing what you're going back for, whereas the first time it kind of felt just like, I'm on Mars. What is this?
You know,
you walk into a service exam, which is a hotel conference room. And it's just a huge amount of people and tables and chaos. And you're just like, what am I doing here? And this guy is like barking orders at you and you kind of have to go from there. So once you've gone through it once, you know, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How'd that feel when you passed?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had to ask, it was Cam Douglas. He's a master sommelier from New Zealand.
I've met him.
You met him?
Last time I was here, we had lunch at Los Lake Bistro because when I went to the North Island,
right.
I used him to, I was like, okay, here are the places I'm going. Here's where I'm thinking of going. What recommendations? So yeah, Cam and I have, you know, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's awesome. He's really cool. He gave me my feedback. So to give feedback, the master has been with you through all parts of your exam. So they've sat on your tasting, they sat at your service table, so they can speak with experience, you know, having been there. So he was really fantastic. He just kind of got right to the chase. You know, I'm here to tell you some good news. You passed. And I think I made him say it like 3 or 4 times.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't believe him. I was like, wait, are you sure?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you can never really... You can feel confident, but not really know at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I asked him 3 times, you know, are you sure you're telling me the truth?
And what were his notes to you? Do you remember?
Pardon me?
Do you remember his notes?
You know what? He told me I had an amazing tasting. I was the first one of the day for that group.
Yep.
I think it's like 9 o'clock or 8:30 or something like that, which was great. I could just wake up and kind of go rip the Band-Aid off of this Achilles heel thing.
That you're not waiting all day.
I wasn't
in
like
your head.
Pacing in a hotel room waiting.
Yeah.
So that was to my benefit. Plus I had a really generous friend of a friend brought a flight of 6 to the hotel the day before, and I blinded a flight of 6 the day before, and it was like one of the best I've done. So I had this great shot of confidence too.
Yeah.
A little off topic, but yeah, so he told me that I was really hard to top, and I was shocked. That's kind of when I asked him again, like, "Are you sure you're the right talking to the right person?" Because tasting has never been easy for me. So,
yeah, tasting it is funny. Just it's always one of the most intimidating things. I remember even in our diploma class, and maybe it's people just don't like to talk, but even the diploma, there's people were always sheepish about, okay, what do you get?
Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah,
I don't think I've read more than 4 tasting notes in our whole diploma class.
Really?
I'm pretty sure. I was that sheepish person. I was always like avoiding the eye contact of...
You never gave...
Like maybe 4, like a handful of times.
You coward.
No, okay, yes, that is true. And I would say to give advice to anybody listening to this, read your tasting notes because you benefit a lot from that feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I'm so introverted when it comes to tasting now. I don't know.
But, yeah. Yeah. Well, let's go through the reason. And again, you don't have to. You can go.
No,
as,
it's
you,
good.
You I'm... can go as great as you want. My favorite was did a white Bordeaux with Bruce, and off the top, he's like, "Yeah, I'll just, you know what? I don't want to bore everyone. I'll just speak for a couple minutes." And then at one point, he looked up. He's like, "How long have I been talking for?" I'm like, "Bruce, you've been talking for 7 minutes."
And also, you made. And did he enjoy it, Bordeaux? I hear he's in. Notoriously not interested.
This was a really good white Bordeaux.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nice. I'm trying to remember. It's got like a G on the Girard. It has a G on the label. You would know it. I mispronounced it already, you would definitely know it.
That's cool.
And yeah, it was really good. White Bordeaux that I got a lot of people at my cottage to fall in love with.
Awesome.
So what do we got here? What are we doing?
All right. Today? Well, we can talk first about the site of this wine because that's important. It's starting to show a little bit of a gold inflection. It's still, you know, still fairly clear at the rim. It's not not a broad watery rim, but it's defined. And just a little bit of a greenish kind of hint as well. On the nose, it does have primary fruit, doesn't it? It still has a little bit of that kind of lemon, lime, pear.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's not past its prime, but...
You don't have to work as hard for this fruit as I thought.
Exactly.
Like going in. I thought it was like Indiana Jones. I'm going to have to go down all these catacombs to find the fruit. It's still there.
And get past this, like, what would be called petrol-y or kind of... dare I use this hated term?
Do it.
Mineral.
I know.
Driven wine.
I know.
It's hard to wrap your mind around that.
But it just works.
It's a poetic license, and it's. I guess it is something that people can identify with.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so. It's not fruit first. This wine, though, hey. No. Yeah, it has a bit of that, like, kind of, plasticky.
Yep.
Inorganic. Petrol.
Here's the thing. Plasticky totally works.
Right.
And for someone who's just getting into wine, they're like, what the bleep are you talking about? But it's true. When you smell it, you're like, yep, that's coming in.
And then that like really beautiful, light honey and beeswax note is coming through.
Yeah.
Floral. It's really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not talking loud, but it's saying something, right?
I'm going to use that as for one of the promotions when I put this out on social media. It's not talking loud, but it's saying something.
Yeah. Yeah.
That works. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, do you like the palate of this wine? I think it's really nicely balanced. Yeah,
tell me about what yes, by the way, I think it's juicy. I think it's wonderful. I think it's still filled with life. I think it's an incredibly easy drinking Riesling, but easy drinking by the same point. If you pause for a second, you go, oh, wait, I'm getting all these different things.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. This is like one of those wines where that beautiful balance between sweetness and acidity is really evident.
Yeah.
But it's not...
It's not sticky.
It's not. Yeah, exactly. But I'm sure given, you know, the alcohol content is probably somewhere around 8. Oh, it's at 10. Mm-hmm. My apologies. 2003 was a pretty warm year.
Do you know what the great thing about that is? 99% of people listening aren't going to question you.
Oh,
because
fair.
You say it with authority. and you just threw that out there. Oh, yeah, 2003 was a very warm year.
Yeah.
You know, almost no one's going to go, even though she knows everything and I know nothing, I'm going to Google that.
You should. You should always question things. I mean, that's the fun part of, I don't know, learning about wine maybe.
But by the way, that right there just shows you how much study you have to do that you remember that 2003 in Peaceport, like in that part of Germany,
sure.
It was a warm year.
I have to... play a little bit of a showing my hands. 2003 was pretty warm year all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly warm year all over Europe. But I digress. Thank you for the compliment.
Yes. So what's on the palate?
Yeah. So this is, it's not a dry wine. It's done in the cabinet style, I believe. Yep. Cabinet style.
What does that mean for people that don't know?
Which means it is a, it's not, so there's a the ranking of German sweetness levels or Praticat. Cabinet tends to be the lightest style, but they're often made with residual sugar.
Yeah.
Then we move up the ranks all the way to the late harvest, you know, hand-selected Trockenbierno Schlese, which is like a dessert wine.
Yeah.
So Cabinet starts that Praticat, but they are often made with just a little bit of sweetness left. Mind you, this is beautiful, beautiful crisp acidity to balance that sweetness. So it's quite a delicate wine, but very precise. If I could say one negative thing about this wine, I would say the finish. It's just falling off a little bit, don't you think?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's you take a sip, and then a second later, you're like, wait.
Yeah.
You know, it ain't lingering. It ain't hanging out with you.
Yeah. It's there. It's nice on the palate. It has fruit. It has mid-palate, but it just kind of falls away.
If I may use, I forget... a song lyric, this wine.
Yeah.
It's here for a good time.
Not a long time.
Not a long time.
Cheers.
Cheers to that. By the way, do you like how the service here at, and they're fantastic in the National Club.
Mm-hmm.
We got this bottle and we didn't know if it was going to be good or not. And we pointed, you know, let's grab, you know, some Jadot, a 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing is that they left it here just in case.
Yeah.
Oh, just in case if you want to also then drink that.
Yeah.
Because
we don't know how long the interview is, so.
And shameful by them because they know the more you drink, oh, who wants some white chart? Who wants some white burgundy? Well, everyone does.
Yes, of course.
So what would you say the biggest difference between just the wine atmosphere of, say, Langdon Hall?
Yep.
Very well-known, famous, opulent in a good way because opulent can sometimes seem tacky.
Yeah.
Spa in where is Langdon Hall? That's Kitchener?
It's very close. Cambridge, Ontario,
Cambridge,
or Blair
yeah.
would be the little kind of hamlet town.
How would you compare there versus downtown George?
Oh, geez. In terms of...
The wine culture?
Yeah, yeah. Langdon's an interesting animal in that it's, you know, in this... It's in a sea of other restaurants or places in southern Ontario, Kitchener, Waterloo, and Cambridge, that aren't necessarily as... wine-driven, I think that's fair to say.
Okay.
I mean, the wine culture is growing in places like that.
Yeah, but it's fine.
It's not like downtown Toronto, which is you can go, you know, three blocks and hit 10 wine bars or...
Yep.
So the Langdon culture is kind of unique, but it's still a culinary destination restaurant, for sure. And that with that comes wine-minded people. Have you visited?
I never went. People should know this, that one of the first times my twin brother, who doesn't drink.
Oh, yes.
My twin brother, who doesn't drink, and they raved about you. They're like, oh, okay. Brie was the best. And then you got him to try a Cab Franc ice wine.
That's right.
Yes. So yeah,
he had a sweet tooth, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, our entire family, all sweet tooth. Yeah. So the only other time he ever drank was we were a bunch of friends. We were in Napa. We were at Opus. And so he tried. The first wine he ever tried was a sip of Opus 1 Cabernet. Mm-hmm. And then the next wine he ever had was that ice wine, that Cab Franc ice wine from you.
Wow. That's exciting. And he spoke kindly of the experience.
So. He did. Oh, yeah, no, he loved it. But what were any crazy bottles? Did you have any guests who brought any crazy bottles?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I opened my first DRC there.
Mm. DRC, again, I always straddle the line because most people listening, they know what DRC is.
But
DRC, of course, is the most prestigious, most expensive, most sought after little tiny producer in all of Burgundy for Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
I've never tried the top. I've tried Latache and some others.
Yeah.
I've yet to try the top level.
Yeah.
What does that smell and taste like?
Well, it was actually DRC Latache.
Okay,
it was
Latache.
Yeah, it was Latache. Yeah, but it was 2000 vintage.
Slumming it, right? With a 2000 Latache.
I was so excited to open that bottle. I had to run to the far cellar for it too, which is like not in the same building. So it was like thinking about it the whole time as I'm coming back.
Don't drop this. Don't drop this.
Yeah, exactly. On this concrete. This car or
this bottle of wine is a Camry. Do not drop this.
Exactly. That was pretty wonderful. I don't know. It was like a truly amazing experience to be able to work there. And one that I think I can wrap my mind around, that not everybody gets to work with a program like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in their, you know, in their career altogether. It's really classic. Like, as you picture, there's lots of first growth Bordeaux and, you know, beautiful Burgundies, Champagnes, and back vintages, which was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was pretty awesome to kind of taste things. And I mean, guests are always willing to, when they know you're excited about a wine, they usually are.
That makes them more excited.
They get excited to share it with you.
Of course, which is such the thing. I mean, that's the thing about wine, is like, you want to share it with people that will enjoy it. And also, if you know someone's bringing in a great bottle of Bordeaux or Burgundy, there can be an insecurity, because also that wine they might have had for 15 years and they spent all this money on it.
Yeah.
Not only do they want to enjoy it, but they want validation from people that know wine.
That they cellared it correctly and exactly.
All that sort of stuff. Okay, this first next question, you have to answer now.
Okay.
But just some of the most memorable bottles you ever have, what you've remembered.
Deal.
So I want you to think about that for a second. But here's an easier one. What does the hardest day for a Somme look like? And you can either use Langdon Hall, you can use George, you can use your current job. What does the hardest day look like?
You know, I think I would have to say the holidays, because like, not only is it the experience of being sometimes soul-crushingly busy on the floor.
Yeah.
But you also have it in the back of your mind that you're not necessarily spending time with your family.
Yeah.
Or your loved ones. Hotel life, you work often Christmas Eve, Boxing Day, New Year's. I can't think of... I've been in hospitality for longer than I should mention, but I can't think of New Year's Eve off.
Do you remember the last...
I don't even know what that feels like.
Okay, so you don't remember New Year's Eve off.
Yeah.
When was the last... Like, when was the last time you had like Christmas? Like, have you ever home for Christmas dinners? Or?
Yeah, actually, when I worked at George in Toronto, despite the fact that it's a boutique hotel, they weren't open for Christmas Day.
Okay, so they shut her down.
Yeah. They're attached to a boutique hotel, rather, not necessarily the restaurant. But I was home for that Christmas. My family one time made a cardboard cutout like with a paper plate and like drew a face on it and put it at the table, and it was like, and sent me pictures of it. So that was kind of a bummer to...
Was that hard?
Yeah. It was a funny joke because it...
It was a funny joke. And of course, and they were trying to do it, you know, they wanted to try to include you. But was that hard? Was that hard for you to see?
Of course it's hard. Yeah. Of course it's hard. You know, you miss your family in the moments. And then on top of it, for example, Christmas Day service at Langton Hall is, I think, probably the busiest day of the year.
Oh, yeah?
Shockingly. Lots of people come in for brunch, and it's this kind of straight through service that starts at 11 o'clock and goes till 10 o'clock at night with full house.
That's tough.
So, you're constantly kind of running around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is tough.
Yeah.
So, some of your favorite bottles.
Oh, gosh. I'm proud to say I've tasted the 1855 classified Premier Grand Cruz, mm-hmm. all the 1982s.
Ooh.
That was pretty special. It happened in a course of the year and a half that I worked at Langdon, or 2 years that I worked at Langdon. Yeah. Not all at the same time. But
do you have a favorite? And that's, they're all so damn good.
Yeah, for where they were, I liked the O'Brien. I thought it was just, it had a lot left to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that one, yeah.
My favorite I've tried of the first growth, and this one's not even that old. I've tried wines from the 70s and stuff. I think I'll say this. My favorite experience was, this was like a year ago, so it had some time to age, and it was decanted for a bunch of hours.
Yeah.
2000 Margaux.
Oh, lovely.
And it just, what amazed me was, it is that perfect combination. It still has that power, but it's not as powerful
power
as Latour's, but power and grace.
Yeah.
And when you were taking the sip, it was transforming in the sip. It wasn't even, by the time the first glass, the second glass, you could tell a difference.
Yeah.
But as it's going down, you're like, there's like a kaleidoscope of emotions and flavors going on.
Yeah.
And that, that for me was probably my favorite.
That's awesome. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say like what a favorite or best bottle is. I think like the cheesy, but probably truthful answer is like, the bottle you share with that special person or group of friends, whatever, and that it may be like,
but there's not
nothing
so cheesy
that
it's,
you brag about, but it's kind of tastes the best.
Yeah, but I mean, so much of it is about experience.
Yeah,
you know, I can think the best bottle of Chardonnay I've ever had, and like our mutual friend Emily Pierce has made the claim that Chardonnay is the greatest grape, and when you think about champagne,
fair.
You can absolutely
Chardonnay's pretty darn noble.
Ooh, maybe later I'm going to get you to rank your top five favorite grapes.
Oh, okay.
But I remember two New Year's ago, so not this past one, but the one before that. It was the coldest New Year's in Toronto in like forever.
Yeah,
and was I was that And I was up at a cottage, my girlfriend's cottage. And I actually, during the day, even though it was freezing, I was able to get a fire going. Like a big
outside?
Outdoor fire
nice.
Right by the water, and had 06 Premier Cru Corton. And I mean, it was just damn good.
Yeah.
But we were drinking it as the sun was setting on the final day of 2017, going into 2018, overlooking the lake on this freezing day, but we're by the fire, so we're warm.
Yep.
And that was one of the top five best bottles of wine I've ever had.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So no, it's true. I mean, it's something that like, it's not always about, ooh, the winemaker or the year or the cost. It's the experience. It's
the
emotion that goes into it.
Yeah. Or even, when you put the wine in context of the dinner table.
Yeah.
You know, and you're experiencing, I think wine shines the best when it's paired with food,
mm-hmm.
Food and maybe as well the company.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Maybe I'll get you to do some food, and I feel like I'm doing too much. I feel like I'm putting you on the spot. Like, I want you to do this. I want you to do that. Well, what are you drinking now?
What am I drinking now?
Yeah. Do you have anything like right now? Because we all go through phases.
You
like,
know, I'm in a little sherry kick at the moment, probably because I'm studying it to researching it to bulk up the FOGO program.
Yep.
Yeah, I've been drinking, and I found out my dad likes it.
Mm-hmm.
My mother can't stand it, and my boyfriend thinks it's okay. So,
okay, so you know, there you got like a little bit.
Happy medium.
Sherry is so hard. It's hard because, you know, there's this image of just like your grandmother drinking it.
Yeah, sure.
And I remember when I went for the diploma graduation in London for the WSET.
Oh, you went to that?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. That's
Yeah. But I'd never been in London before.
Ah, cool.
So it was like a perfect, just use this as an excuse.
Yeah, yeah.
The first night we got there, where did we go? I dragged my girlfriend and her twin to a sherry bar.
Of course.
To the biggest sherry bar in London.
Yeah. So, obviously, I picture the London version of a sherry bar to be, like, pretty massive.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Just flights after flights. And they brought a friend of theirs.
Yeah.
None of them like sherry.
Okay.
So, they eventually shifted over to dry Spanish reds.
Yeah.
And I just was just sherry the whole night. It's awesome. And sherry is one of the cheapest forms of wine out there when you consider the time and what goes into it.
100%. And the age often.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's wild to think. And I've been trying to kind of understand how this works, because if other wineries keep such massive stocks of back vintage wines, they appreciate, and you know, then they can release these wines as library releases, so on and so forth. But sherry is just, this is what we do. Like, this is how it's made. You know, we keep these massive Solera systems of mature wines for years and years and years.
And it's just sitting and sitting.
Yeah, and it's an interesting culture for sure. I'd love to visit. I haven't been to Spain, so.
It's my next two trips.
Is it?
Is
where are you going?
Spain, Portugal.
Nice.
I want to do a 2-week there.
Okay.
And that won't be enough time, but you know, life.
Yeah.
And then the other one, I think the first one I'm going to do is in honor of what we're drinking, but it is my next trip.
Yeah.
I want to do just rent a car, Moselle, Rheingau, like do Germany for a week and a week and a half, and then do Austria and go to Wachau.
Nice.
So I just, that's the big one I want to do.
That would be good. Are you planning like seasons for that? Are you going to do Germany, Austria in the summer, or
I'm thinking I want to do Septembers. I want to do where it's still warm enough, but we're out of the busy season. Mm. I hate the busy season.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the waiting and the lineups,
airports
and just everything.
Yep.
How long were you at George for?
I was at George for a year. And it was a really intense year. It was a wonderful experience, though.
Yeah. I love, and by the way,
you love coming there.
I loved. George, fantastic restaurant, great list.
Yeah.
Queen East, around Queen and Church.
Yeah.
And I love, like, yeah. Oh, I came a couple times when I knew you were there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I brought my closest friend, who is a huge wine guy, and it was always a treat. You were always fantastic. And a couple times there was wine reps there that started pouring us other stuff. It was just wonderful. But just your thoughts of the Toronto wine scene.
You know what? George is a bit of an island in a sense, because it's a wonderful wine destination restaurant, but not a lot of, outside of reps, maybe entertaining clients, not a lot of sommeliers drink there.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while. I think the price tag can be a bit intimidating.
Yes.
To sit down for a 10-course
meal. It's not cheap.
And wine
it's
pairings,
expensive.
It's an expensive night. Yeah. And it's a memorable night. It's awesome. The food is good. But it was a bit of a hidden gem in that. I don't know how much you know about how the wine pairings work at George.
No.
So the menu is served. There's an a la carte, but the choice of tasting menu would be in either 5, 7, or 10 courses. And if, let's say, you and I sat down for dinner, and we both ordered 10 courses, we would each get 10 different plates. So if then on top of that, we were doing wine pairings, it would be 20 different wines coming to the table. So having to sustain that throughout the evening, you have so much wine open.
The amount of work.
Yeah. But no, it's a playground. Like
that
was one of my most favorite parts of that job, is that you can, just like the menu, the wines are being poured blind. They're kind of a sommelier selection. So you can really just kind of be creative, and you don't need to pour the same wines for the different tables. It's kind of a
free-for-all. How much joy did you take from that? Because that sounds just wildly creative.
You know what? Unless you're like severely in the weeds, where you are just kind of trying to stay ahead of the kitchen firing courses, which didn't happen all that often, but it did happen. Those moments were kind of frantic, but it was awesome.
Yeah.
I loved it. And there was always a team of sommeliers on. So you're kind of standing around the central wine service table and, you know, nerding out, like blind tasting each other, or
it's so
just doing like somm nerd things. Yeah. And
it is so geeky.
Yeah.
Like the wine, and like, you know, I get to hang out with it every now and then. I'm not there all the time.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, I love being in the maelstrom of the wine nerdiness. But
yeah,
for people who don't know, man, is it geeky. Like, just people are freaking out about some strange Sylvaner, or, you know, just some...
Have you tasted this or
some
that?
Obscure wine, or like... Is you know, people that come in, I'm only drinking Tasmanian Pinot. That's all I'm drinking right now. Like, just
cool. Bust out the Chromian.
Yeah,
there you go.
See, bam. There you. I dropped that ball, and you picked that right up.
There you go.
It's so geeky.
And did you know the somms I worked with, like Ian Thresher? He's he works for Nicholas Pierce.
By the way, Pierce, if you're listening, I need to get all those guys. I want all the Nicholas Pierce people.
Oh, that would be a good
on
interview.
This pod. Okay,
that would be
awesome. I want. Because
you should do a group interview.
No, I like doing one-on-one.
Okay.
One-on-one at first, and then eventually a group one. But I'm a huge fan. I bought a lot of Nicholas Pierce.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I feel they own it.
Oh, they have an incredible portfolio.
They got a great
portfolio.
It's
probably one of my favorites.
Yeah. From cheapy Chenin Blanc from South Africa to some really good single vineyard Pinots from Oregon. And all the stuff in France and stuff. It's a great list.
Yeah.
All right. We haven't even gone biographical.
What?
What's that word? Not biographical. Biography.
I don't know. I don't know. Biographically?
Yeah, biographically. I'm screwing this up.
We'll say it.
And by the way, for people listening, this is 10%.
It's a 10% Riesling.
It's 10% Riesling. They were far from slurry stage.
Yeah.
How'd you get into wine?
Let's see. Well, I worked in hospitality, like I said, for a long time.
Yep.
Like all through my early 20s. Mm-hmm. I think probably the catalyst was, though, a long-term relationship I had in my mid-20s with a guy who used to sell wine for Lifford.
Yep.
So through that, I went from drinking, you know, the garbage that you drink before you know much about wine and, you know, very sweet reds. And I didn't like wine. It was never the beverage I would choose to go to. I would drink beer or spirits. But once I met Johnny and we were together for some time, he would bring home wines from tastings, or he just had a better taste than I did. We'll just leave it at that. And so at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think he still drinks well now, but
I'm sure he does.
Didn't continue down the wine path.
I would imagine if we went back in time to the zenith of that relationship and you guys did a wine Olympics in terms of tasting theory and service, maybe he would have won. I think today, I don't know the gentleman, but I imagine today you would lap his ass. Because again, people listening need to know, the voice you hear in Brie is one of the more accomplished people this business.
Thank you.
So yeah, I'm sure you would lap him now. So it started first just working in restaurants and then eventually just being with someone in Lifford. And then,
that's right. The wine culture in Kitchener-Waterloo at the time wasn't massive. There weren't a lot of places you could go to necessarily to have an interesting glass of wine. And that's changing now, which is great. But there is also a solid little group of people that live out that direction that are doing WSET or CMS related courses. So yeah, it's a good little community. But I did commute into the city, and that's, as you know, where we met.
Where we hung out in the hotel room on the final night when it was just a coincidence. And you were on the same floor
I was. That was so funny.
And the main thing I remember for the diploma exam.
You were into
exam,
it.
Well, for me, though, is because I don't work in wine.
Yeah.
You know, I always felt I was always trying to catch up.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't work in restaurants or things like that. I worked in sports media.
Yeah.
You know, so we're there. You know, it's a very different world. But I remember you and I hanging out before at Franz.
The breakfast place. Is that what it's called? Yeah.
And I had to go pee like 17 times.
I think it was nerves.
It was total. I remember picking up my first glass of wine for the tasting.
Yeah.
And my hand was like shaking. And I made the biggest mistake. And I mean, thankfully I passed the first time round.
Yeah.
But I tried to game the first couple wines.
Oh, you look at it and you were like, this looks like such and such.
I looked, I smelled like, oh, this must be Spanish white. All these wines are from Spain. And then I got to the first red. I'm like, oh shit, this is Cap Franc. This is absolutely Loire Cap Franc.
Oh, it was that's right. Now I'm remembering that flight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I like that when they will put into a flight something that's a bit more of a known or recognizable. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had to go back and redo all my notes for the couple other wines because I'm like, nope, you are very wrong.
Oh, no way. You passed.
It was so stressful. And I had the bunion on my finger for 3 hours of writing theory.
Oh, gosh,
I think there was mountain climbers at the summit but stay the night because, you know, the air, you know, the oxygen level at the top.
Oh, gosh.
Before I always like to ask this, what tips would you give people listening in terms of making wine less intimidating? People are getting into wine.
Yeah.
What tips would you give? Because this podcast is meant to make wine supposed to be more approachable and more fun. And we've geeked out a whole whack because we haven't seen each other in ages. People need to know. I haven't seen Brie in well over
at least a year.
Yeah,
if not a little bit more. Maybe at a tasting or something recently, but
yeah.
Yeah.
But what sort of tips would you give to people that are getting into wine who just want to learn more about it?
Sure. I would say that, you know, if you go to a restaurant with a sommelier and you don't know a lot about reading a wine list or even like what you like in terms of how to define what you like, just ask the sommelier questions.
Yeah.
The average person who works as a sommelier is a hospitality professional first and foremost, and they should be a kind person to speak to.
Yes.
You know, they shouldn't make you feel small or ignorant for asking questions or not knowing, you know, the nitty gritty or the details. I think it's funny because wine, it's expected of you that you know something before you enjoy it, but it's not the case. You can always like a wine before you know necessarily where it comes from or the grape varietal.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Oh, you God, know? Yeah.
Like, how many people like Chablis before they know it's Chardonnay grape?
Yeah.
And then when you tell them it's Chardonnay grape and then they try a Chardonnay from somewhere else, you know, that's a sense of exploration.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I always tell people, you know, write down if you like it, yep. write down the name yep. and write down where it's from
yep.
and then sort of go from there. I'm curious, how would you read a, like, especially, well, no, at all the places, yep. just because very different clientele, what are your techniques in terms of serving people and especially the people that are a little bit sheepish, maybe they only have a certain amount of spend or they're uncomfortable with their wine knowledge
yep.
and they want to feel they know more. Like, how do you shepherd them to the right bottle?
I don't always make price point the first and foremost thought, but oftentimes it's nice to recommend something that's within somebody's, on the lower end of somebody's comfort zone.
Yeah.
You know, questions I would ask, not necessarily in any particular order, would be, you know, what do you drink at home? Is there a particular wine or producer that you like or style or grape? And if they can answer that question, that's a wonderful tip.
Now you're off to the races.
You can hook into that for sure. If they're not necessarily comfortable answering that, you can ask them, you know, obviously knowing what they're eating is a huge part of it. You want to make the pairing as harmonious as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then you can ask, what's your price range?
Yep.
That's not a tacky question. It's an important thing to know.
But it's tough. Money is so uncomfortable.
It can be uncomfortable. Yeah. Especially if it's like a client or, you know, a first date or something.
Oh, yeah.
You can sometimes get around that by kind of pointing out a few different selections within, you know, something like this or something like this and kind of pointing to the wine list, a range of things. What else? I don't know.
All right. I got a question for you.
Yeah.
I thought about this as you were answering. Have you ever wanted to save someone? Like you ask them what they like. And I'm sorry to rip on certain wines.
Okay.
I've talked about in past podcasts. So the heavy new world, probably lots of extra sugar and chemicals added.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a moment where someone has said, oh, I really like this, this, and this. And the back of your mind, you're like, ooh, gross. But you don't want to say that because wine is intimidating. And
yes,
you want to. The great thing is if someone drinks a wine that you think is gross, eventually maybe they explore and then they try other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they grow and maybe they don't. And maybe they just like the gross wine and they're happy with it. Fine.
Yeah.
I'm doing 1,000 qualifiers to this question.
No,
because I always get uncomfortable with this because it's always that fine line if you don't want to demean someone. But have you ever tried to save someone when they say they like something like, huh, okay, well, why don't we try this?
Yeah. I know what you're talking about, and I can picture the wines that you speak of, and I understand it. Yeah. For example, sweetness levels in mass-produced, let's say, California red wines.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there's plenty of good mass-produced. If people want a good Wente Cabernet Sauvignon, 1895, has one-third the sugar of Apothic Red. Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you... sometimes you can not necessarily swap out sweetness for fruitiness, but you know that the guest who enjoys a sweet mass-produced California red wine also appreciates things like softness,
mm-hmm.
Fruit-forward character.
Yeah.
So you can maybe go to a drier style, but just maintain that those things are still present in the wine.
Yep.
So look for grapes like Zinfandel, which can be fortified to dryness, but would still be kind of plump and soft and fruit forward.
Yeah.
But then you can maybe take them outside of that 12 grams per liter, whatever the heck is in. I don't even...
17.
Oh, my. Okay.
Apothic Red, 17.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah. Anyway, this is something I've been crusading. I don't know why. It's something we've... You know what it was? I think I talked about it on a podcast. I was at a party, a lot of younger people.
Yeah.
And... someone had bought a bottle I recommended, this like entry level Barbaresco that was like $4 or $5 off. Yeah. So it was only like $24.95.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they had the Apothic Red. I'm like, okay. Gave them an ounce of each. Try them both. Let me know what you think. And they were just shocked.
Yeah.
They were just shocked.
Yeah. They can be really different, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It can be.
Sugar can hide a lot of.
It's an apology.
Maybe. Yeah.
It's an apology.
It's a way to mask bad quality fruit, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
In that sense.
And the thing is, I'm not against mass produced. Mass produced is a great thing because it's a lower cost and people don't always have a lot of. I have no children, so I can spend more money on wine, but people don't always have that. So it's a great place to start. I always recommend go drink some good mass produced wine. I've recommended wines over $9. Hell, I can recommend my favorite box wine. Black Box, by the way, in the United States. Black Box, their Chardonnay and their Chilean Cab are actually pretty good.
Interesting. You should, if you like box wines, please, please, please try this next summer when it comes out.
Okay.
I think it's just summer that they bring it, it on. It's from the Vine Agency. The producer is a co-op from Sicily called Valdibella.
Yeah.
And they do, I believe, the whitest Catarato Comune.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is a Nero d'Avola-based red. And the Rosato, I cannot for the life of me remember. I think it's Pericone they use. I'm not sure. But all three delicious, organic, co-op produced fruit, which is fantastic.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's good levels everywhere.
Yeah.
Your top five, we'll go grapes.
Okay.
And by the way, you can go like, you know, you can go Sonoma Pinot or Burgundy Pinot.
Specific.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay. No, you can absolutely be more specific. In fact, I want you to be more specific.
Okay. I think, though it's a challenging grape, Nebbiolo is probably up there. Okay, can I just give you my top five but not give a context of 1 to 5?
Okay, you're being cowardly,
is that fair?
But sure. No, no. You know what? I'll let
just
it go
because
I put you on the spot. Okay, Nebbiolo, that would be in my top five.
Nebbiolo is in my top five, specifically from the appellations of Barolo and Barbaresco.
Yep.
I just think there's like something intensely haunting and beautiful about the way those wines are and how they age. You know.
Oh, God.
They're easy to love.
I've been there twice.
Yeah.
It's by the way, that would have been so hipster if you went, I'm going Nebbiolo, but I'm actually going to go
Rorero.
Just like some other area. Like, oh,
Gemme
God, Rorero would have been so hipster. But even worse, you'd be like, I visited this place in Temecula, and they actually did, anyway. Okay.
Baja, California, Baja, Mexico.
Yeah. You'd be shocked, but you know, the winds from the Pacific. Anyway, so okay, Nebbiolo, yep.
Nebbiolo.
By the way, that was so geeky, those last 20 seconds.
I know. Just
I'm so
that,
sorry.
Nebbiolo is definitely haunting and charming and all of that. Chardonnay, I'm with Emily. Chardonnay is like not only a bit of a cheerleader grape, like it really takes terroir and winemaking and expresses them well, but it still maintains who it is.
I mean, from New Zealand to BC to Ontario,
Canada, exactly.
Prince Edward County to, of course, Chardonnay. Okay, so you're just doing general Chardonnay.
Yep. I maybe made myself a t-shirt a few years ago that says Chenin Blanc is my homegirl. So I'm going to have to give a nod to Chenin.
Okay, where's Chenin?
Specifically Loire.
Yep.
Although it does beautiful things in South Africa.
Of course.
I've had interesting examples from California, but I think, I think Loire.
Vouvray or Sauvignon?
Sauvignon? Mm-hmm. I said it with a question mark
you
on the
did,
end of it.
You did.
Because, of course, there are the greats of, there are great producers from Vouvray. And I think because Sauvignon tends towards dryness or is, frankly, much drier.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's why I find the balance a little bit nicer.
Yeah. Okay, you got two more. You got Nebbiolo, you got Chardonnay, and we were getting Loire, Chenin Blanc.
Riesling, I have to say Riesling.
Everyone does. Yeah. No, anyone who's in the wine world, you're contractually obligated to say Riesling.
I think so, yeah. It's like you get your advanced sommelier certificate, and then you sign the I Love Riesling clause. No, I'm kidding.
No, that's there. In fact, even at the WSET diploma, they will not give it to you until you swear allegiance to Riesling.
Yeah, for sure. It's such a gastronomic wine, though.
It's like, awesome.
It's food friendly. It's versatile. It comes in a range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got four. You got one more.
Oh, my gosh. How did I end up with only one left and both Syrah and Pinot Noir haven't been mentioned?
Which one are you choosing? Sophie's choice here.
I don't know. And then there's all the Italian great whites. Come on.
You only get five. I mean, listen, I'm not saying that 6 through 79 aren't fantastic.
Fair enough. Okay, fine.
Can I guess? Can I guess?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm going to say you're going to say Syrah.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah.
If I had to.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, like we're leaving out, I already feel like we're leaving out so many grapes, right?
You've left out all of Bordeaux and you've left off all of Burgundy, red Burgundy.
Yeah. That's a tough question.
I know it's a tough question.
Can I turn it around? What are yours?
My five, we have about 2 minutes left.
Oh, then it's go time.
Nebbiolo is definitely going to be there. Chardonnay from everywhere is going to be there. Riesling is going to be there. So those three, 100%.
Yep.
Then my other two, I am going to go with, Cabernet. I'm going to go with Cabernet Sauvignon from Left Bank.
Okay.
And then my final one, I mean, do I just go full Beatles White Album and go Pinot Noir from Burgundy?
That's legit.
No, I mean.
We're naming classics. And classics are classics for a reason.
Classics are classics for a reason.
As much as I love
and by the way, Syrah,
innovation or even native grapes from Italy or Portugal. Yeah.
No, you got to go. Anyone who has Portuguese, some sort of funky Portuguese grape that no one's ever heard of. Again, hipster. Such a hipster. We're out of time.
All right.
This has been so good, Bray. I really appreciate. I hope. I'd love to come by Fogo. I want
to
come to Fogo.
To have you, honestly.
And I want to come and I want to bring all my equipment. And
awesome.
I want to do another interview with you when we're having like a glass of wine dramatically overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
You will love the view. It's fantastic. I look out of my window in the dining room every day and I'm just like thankful I get to have that office view. It's crazy.
It looks fantastic. Yeah. Again, congratulations. Someone I went to school with for several years. Hell, studied with the final night before WSET diploma.
Yep.
Just everything that you've accomplished, your work ethic, it is fantastic. Congratulations for everything, Brie.
Thank you so much.
This has been the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find this podcast on Spotify, on Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.